So last time we looked at really the major preludes to the Enlightenment. What all served to help kind of bring about the Enlightenment? So we looked at the scientific revolution led by men like Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton. We saw this growing question of authority. Where is objective and final authority found? We saw how the overwhelming majority of the kind of early enlightened thinkers, Newton, Bacon, Locke, all of them still held a fairly high view of Scripture. Obviously, they had some areas in their Christianity or that were not necessarily orthodox, a lot of them leaning more towards deism, getting away from the Trinity, kind of having a lower view of Christ, but nevertheless, they still were trying to hold on to a vestige of Christianity in a lot of ways. And so they were not ready to say that science was the final authority. But over time, the seeds that they planted would be sown into much of the thinkers that we are going to see tonight in the philosophes. We saw the movement away from rationalism of men like Descartes, where reason is the ultimate epistemology or how we know what we know, to now we're moving towards a more empirical view of epistemology. That simply means what we can observe. It now is starting to be built upon what is known as the scientific method. We can only know that which can be tested, says Francis Bacon. And so we need to be able to observe things, experiment them, and that is how we can ultimately know what we know. And then we saw a movement away from the biblical view of human nature. The biblical view outlining the fact that men are depraved, that they're born in original sin, that we have a fallen nature that needs to be redeemed. John Locke comes in and says, I don't think so. I think all men are created good, and it ultimately is their surroundings, their context that shapes them. And so it's that old nature versus nurture argument. And Locke shifts away from the idea that it's nature that's ultimately wrong. And he says it's nurture. The environment must be changed. And if the environment is changed, then man will stay good in most cases. Now, all of these men, like I said, were avowed Christians in their own right. And we can say, not necessarily an orthodox standard, but in their own words, they were. They believed in a God. But nevertheless, these new group of thinkers that would really basically be born out of their ideas, would take the foundations that were laid by men like Bacon and Newton and Locke, and they would build upon them their own anti-Christian philosophical systems, ushering in what is known as the Age of Lights or the Enlightenment. Now, like I was telling Freddie before we started, we could spend a year on the Enlightenment itself, and all of the thinkings, but that would really defeat our purpose in a church history class. Our point is really to outline the major systems of thinking that are affecting the reason that the church is shifting. So we must speak on the Enlightenment in order to understand the other movements that are happening, the response, especially when we look at the beginning of the 19th century and the rise of what we would call Protestant liberalism is really much a response, I would say a negative one, to the Enlightenment. So we need to know what are they dealing with? What's the church dealing with right now in its context? And in order to try and spend just one lecture series on the Enlightenment, I want to spend time focusing on the one group of thinkers that really sums up the ideas and the thinking that came out of the Enlightenment. And this group is known as the philosophes. These were the French philosophers of the 18th century that really basically planted and built the foundation of the Enlightenment. Every single person that comes after them is nothing more than a vestige of these men. And so that's why I think if you can understand who the philosophes were, you can pretty much understand all of the developments that happened in Western civilization after them, and even the vast majority of what we would consider militant atheists today do nothing but regurgitate the thoughts of the vast majority of these men. And so if you know who these are, then you can pretty much get your head around what was the major ideas behind the Enlightenment. So we're going to look at the philosophes tonight. The overwhelming majority of the most celebrated philosophers in the 18th century were raised in French culture in either France or the Republic of Geneva. And so, real quickly, if you haven't been with us for a while, I've simply put up just a few brief slides for you guys to look at so you can listen to me instead of trying to read and listen at the same time. I know that that can be kind of distracting. So we'll have some different pictures up for you guys here in a bit, but I'm going to do most of the lecturing just from up here. So basically, these individuals were raised pretty much in two major areas. They were French culture, whether they were in the nation of France or in the French-dominated culture of Geneva, the Republic of Geneva. These two areas were dominated by French culture, and in the 18th century, it was really the French who dominated the area of philosophy and thinking. Now, these philosophers ranged from deists, that is, those who believed in a God, just not one who actively intervened. They did not believe in the Trinity. They did not believe in really the miracles and superstitions that are often painted in the Bible. They just simply believed there's a God, he created everything, he wound up the watch, and now he's let it run. He's basically hands off, doesn't get involved, and ultimately, whatever happens, happens, happens here on earth. That was the deist, and the other group was the atheist. The atheist will come along a little bit later on with men like Denis Diderot, but nevertheless, they will become basically full-on launched during this period in France. They included political thinkers like monarchists who believed in the need for a king, men like Voltaire, de Holbach, and Republicans. The first time we start seeing these big Republican thinkers, men like Jean-Jacques Rousseau. We're going to look at all of these thinkers tonight. But one thing they shared in common, in spite of all of their division and their disdain oftentimes for each other, one thing they shared in common was their disdain for organized religion and their disdain for what was known as Christianity during that period. They saw Christianity as that which held men in darkness, hence the age of lights. They needed to bring light into the world to get men away from the superstition darkness, which they believed the Christianity of their day reflected. Basically, with that being said, we're going to kind of look now at how these individuals were really beginning to how this all began to rise. And the first thinker that really brings this all about was a man by the name of Baron de Montesquieu. Now, Montesquieu is really the first major French philosopher, and it was his work, Spirit of the Laws, which really began to push people away from Christianity and actually start putting this idea of deism and kind of attacking the Christian God in public. Before this, most of the philosophers did most of their writing just amongst each other. They did things from hand to hand. They passed letters to one another in fear of being imprisoned for their beliefs, being seen as heretics or blasphemers. And so the first time Montesquieu actually puts this work of deistic philosophy out in the open and begins to challenge the traditional thinking of the day. And with Montesquieu, these philosophers who were once hidden in the shadows now get marched onto center stage there in French culture. Where Newton had attempted to discover the laws of nature, Montesquieu, who was a very powerful politician, he tried to discern the laws of that which govern human relations. So Newton said that there are a set of laws which God has given to govern nature. Montesquieu believed that likewise there were laws which governed human nature. That if we could understand these laws, we could help basically create the ideal and the perfect society. In many ways, Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws was the first really sophisticated work of what we would call today sociology. So every sociology department, you're going to listen and learn about Montesquieu. And he believed that there were factors which govern human relationship, that if you could get them in the perfect homeostasis, the perfect balance, you could create a perfect human society. All of these factors included climate, that is, you know, what's going on. Well, not only environmentally, is it a good climate for individuals to live in? Is it a harsh climate? But also, what's the climate politically? What's the climate class-wise, economically? Also, what about religion? Do they all have a homogenous religion where everybody believes the same or not? What are the laws that they're passing there? What are the maxims of that government? What do they focus on in their history? Is history important to that society? Is it not? What is that society's habits and manners? And he believed that you could explain the function and the purpose of a society based upon how it dealt with those specific factors. And if you could tweak those factors in just the right kind of way, you could create a perfect human society. He wrote, quote, "In this sense, all beings have their laws. The material world, its laws. The intelligences superior to man, that's the angels and demons, their laws. The beast, their laws. And man, his law." Montesquieu, through the spirit of the laws, sought to argue for really many fascinating correlations. For instance, he argued that monarchies always thrived better in Catholic lands, whereas republics, which is what the United States would be, function better in Protestant lands. Now, that's pretty clear why that's the case. I think it's not a very difficult correlation. Catholics already have a hierarchical authority structure, right? They have a pope, a papacy that governs everything, and their priesthood is hierarchical. And so it's not shocking that they would be much more willing to submit to a king who is far more hierarchical and that kind of framework. Protestants have a higher tendency to push on the focus towards the individual, the individual's rights, the individual's religion, the individual's relationship with God, the priesthood of all believers. And so they have a tendency to elevate themselves as an ability to have a government that is more congregational, corporate. And this idea is stretched into this idea of a republic. And so it's amazing to see how, theologically speaking and worldview speaking, that falls into the political realm as well. And Montesquieu really paints light to that. Like we've been trying to say in our Sunday mornings, this idea that our religion, our Christian worldview, is something that doesn't have effects in other areas of life, other realms of life, is really just silly. Montesquieu offered compelling reasons for the separation of powers and government. The first time to really provide an understanding for the need of what was called checks and balances. Montesquieu writes that and he says, this is the only way to avoid tyranny. Now you can imagine there were these drafters of this thing called a constitution that were very much influenced by this man Montesquieu and another man we'll see in a little bit named Rousseau. All of these thinkers are creating a foundation which specifically the founders of the American Revolution and the American Constitution will very much pick up and run with. Montesquieu's God, however, was a very impersonal one. He was a deist through and through. He did not believe that he needed anything from Christianity to support or give warrant to his findings, which always possessed a materialistic and a secular orientation. He did not believe we need God to explain things. We don't need God to explain things. We don't need God to try and be the ultimate answer. We don't need providence to understand history. We simply need to understand nature and realize there is a God, but he has left us to govern this world for ourselves. And we need to do the best with what we have. That was really the idea of deism. But Montesquieu would not be alone. As Montesquieu ushered in this idea of philosophical thinking and deism, a new man would eventually rise up in France. And this man would be what we would call the father, not only of the Enlightenment, but really the father of classical liberalism. And this man was a man by the name of François-Marie Arouet, or who would give himself the name Voltaire. Voltaire, an extremely important figure when we think of the Enlightenment. He was witty, irrepressible, and he was very sacrilegious. Voltaire is by far the most famous of all the philosophers. Now, Voltaire was no atheist, as we will see later. He was very much a deist. He very much avowed a belief in a God, but he totally denounced the Christian God in every way. Voltaire was a remarkable letter writer. He was a poet, a dramatist, a historian, and an amazing social commentator. And he has been considered by many historians as the shepherd or the pastor of the anti-Christian flock. And that really is kind of Voltaire's take in all of this. It was during his time in college that Voltaire began to encounter teaching with deistic leanings, and there he became ever so troubled by the problem of evil. And we're not going to necessarily dive into that problem tonight or try to solve it. It's not our place to do so. But the problem of evil, for those who are understanding, is pretty basic. The idea is, if God is all good, if he's all powerful, then how can evil exist? If evil exists, he is either not all good, or he is either not all powerful. And that really becomes the idea of the problem of evil. Now, Christians throughout history have painted this and have addressed this. I love when atheists come to us with the problem of evil, as if that never came across our mind either. But the vast majority of Christians throughout all history have dealt with this, some providing a really amazing arguments, others providing very bad arguments. But nevertheless, we have provided arguments for the problem of evil. But this very much troubled Voltaire. He had a hard time understanding how the Christian God could exist if evil also existed simultaneously, and for what he saw as unchecked within this world. He began doing biblical criticism, which had been growing, as we saw last time. And during this theological crisis that he was facing, he grew more and more skeptical and started writing of his own views, really, which were anti-Christian, and ultimately got him imprisoned in 1770. Now, his imprisonment did not last very long, but nevertheless, after he was released, he was now fully set that he was going to attack and undermine what he believed was the false god of the Christian scriptures. He believed it was evil, and so he tried to really paint the picture of his revolt against Christianity by going against his father and his brother, who were both Jansenists, really following Pascal in their thinking. And he changed his name to Voltaire as a revolt against his Christian upbringing and parents and his brother's faith. And so he was going to be Voltaire and get rid of his name Arouet, which had Christian attachment to it. After being arrested a second time for some of his teachings, Voltaire traveled to England, where there was a greater, much greater toleration for thinking at this time. Most of the preludes to the Enlightenment, men like Newton and Locke, were all English thinkers. At this point, England had a high view of tolerance. Remember the Act of Toleration in 1689? With that came a high view of allowing people to kind of think outside the box. They could publish their ideas much more freely and didn't worry about having to be imprisoned for it like they would in France. And there, so there was a high view of religious toleration, a high view of changing and challenging existing paradigms. And in England, Voltaire first became acquainted with men like Isaac Newton and John Locke. And he found in them the ammunition needed to attack the old order. He believed that they had given him the weapons that he could now use to finally take out Christianity. And this was best seen in his first major work, known as The English Letters. It was published in 1733, and he elevated English society over French society, as well as taking shots at the most notable Christian opponent of the philosophes during that day, Blaise Pascal. Blaise Pascal was the leading Christian apologist during this period, especially in France. The vast majority of French society had turned towards a Jansenist faith during this period and saw Pascal as kind of the great defender of Christianity. And unfortunately for Pascal, who was really a lot, mostly unable to defend most of his views at this point in his life, he was kind of the pinnacle of attack. The philosophes knew if we can attack Pascal and undermine Pascal's arguments, then we can shake the foundations of French society if we can take out Christianity's greatest apologist during this period. And so they did what most people do, especially militant atheists today. They attacked Pascal's view of human nature, which he believed in total depravity. They attacked Pascal's view of the sovereignty of God and salvation. They detested doctrines like election and predestination. They thought those were wicked, horrific doctrines, that if such a God did exist, he would be a devil, said Diderot, who we'll look at later on. And they undermined Pascal's famous argument known as Pascal's wager. Now, real quickly, just to briefly sum you up on, give you a very crude understanding of what Pascal's wager is. It's basically this idea that it is better off that I live as if God exists to find out that he doesn't and lose nothing, rather than to not live as God exists and find out he does exist and lose everything. That's basically the idea. If all things are equal and God is true, God exists, it is better to live as he exists to find out that he doesn't and not lose anything. What if you lost? You lived a good life, you die, hey, you go to nothing. Or you live as if God is, or you live as if God exists. If you don't live as if God exists and find out that he does, well, then you have an eternity of hell to spend. That's really Pascal's wager. Now, the problem with their arguments against Pascal's wager is Pascal's wager was not a proof for God. Pascal was not arguing that this is some kind of proof for God's existence. He was simply arguing that based upon the proof of God's existence, this is the wager by which all humanity finds itself in. Now, there are a lot of problems with Pascal's wager. It's very easy to pick holes through, and that's exactly what Voltaire and men like Diderot and the philosophes did. Voltaire argued that it was a childish argument, and that ultimately there is no proof of God based upon something that you just merely wish but you believe to be true. So just because you wish and you hope that there's a God and that things will work out for good, that does not therefore mean that there is a God. It could mean you're just crazy. And Diderot takes it even farther. And I believe Diderot's argument is actually the better one. Diderot argues you can use that wager for any religion. In other words, the Muslim imam could use the same argument. You should live as if Allah exists. And if he doesn't, well then what do you lose? But if he doesn't and Allah does exist, well then you now have hellfire for eternity. And so you can basically pick and plug whatever God you want there. Or what if your God's the wrong God, right? That was all Diderot's argument. So these were ways in which they plucked holes in Pascal's wager. Unfortunately, they did very little, in my estimation, to deal with Pascal's actual proofs for God. But nevertheless, they meant to attack him any way that they could to shake the foundations of the great Christian apologist. So from 1744 to 1747, Voltaire resided in the court of Louis XV at Versailles. But he was a very, what's a good word? He had a very high view of himself. We'll just say that, which most men at this time do and during this culture. He had a very high view of himself. And ultimately, King Louis's mistress couldn't stand him. She just couldn't stand him because of how high he talked about himself. He wouldn't shut up. He was always talking about these philosophical ideas. And so she couldn't stand him. And so ultimately, he had to leave there. He had to leave. And so he began traveling throughout Europe with his mistress, who was a formidable mathematician herself. Actually, one of the first great female mathematicians. A lady named by the name of Madame du Châtelet, one of the great female mathematicians of history. By late 1754, he was fatigued from traveling, and Voltaire arrived in Geneva, of all places. And there he hoped to woo these reformed Christians coming from the line of Calvin to his form of deism. He said, if I can undermine, if I can take Geneva by storm, then I can fully do in Protestantism forever. And in many ways, he may have been right regarding that. Residing in a stately manner, he tried to woo these Calvinist Christians, these Protestant Christians there in Geneva, by throwing huge parties and just inviting them. Great food, great music, trying to woo them with this kind of great French culture. And many of them were drawn to that. They were amazed. They thought he was extremely brilliant and intelligent. And he went after the most vulnerable of people, that is, seminary students. He believed that if you can affect the seminary students, what have you just filled a generation of churches with? You're thinking. Beloved liberal colleges jumped right onto that. Liberal seminaries jumped right onto this. And if you can affect seminaries, you can affect entire generations and multi-generations of Christianity and thinking. Because you are now putting someone in the pulpit with that is pushing forth your ideas. He believed that he had found two very important potential disciples and two of Geneva's principal pastors, men like Jacob Vernus and Jacob Vernet. It's interesting that their names were very similar. However, he was sorely disappointed by the actions of these pastors. You see, these men in private had actually questioned their faith. They had agreed with some of his philosophies. They had given him ideas that he thought was very antagonistic to Christianity. And so Voltaire decided to take what they had told him in private and make it public. He published it what these pastors were saying and what he saw as the movement away from biblical Christianity. And he published it into a big work known as the Encyclopedia, done by Denis Diderot. And he believed that this was going to set the stage. I have shown that the principal pastors of Geneva are moving away from biblical views of Christianity. Unfortunately for him, the moment this came out publicly, they immediately denounced it all. We don't believe any of that. That's not what we believe, because they knew they would have gotten run out of Geneva in a heartbeat. And so they denounced it all. They said, no, we never said that. We don't believe that. And this angered Voltaire greatly. He believed that they were cowards. He tried to press them on their ideas publicly, and they continued to recant and say, we never said any of those things. And this drove Voltaire to a further disdain for Christianity. He says they're liars. They can't even be honest with themselves. They have a private position and then a public one. And he said, I don't like that. And that is one area that I fully agree with Voltaire. I think that is cowardice and disgusting, to hold one view in private but to lie to your congregation with other views. I think that is evil and wicked. But this drove him to a disdain, and it's probably seen in one of his great attacks on Christianity in a book that he wrote called The Fall of Fanaticism. In this, Voltaire mocked the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And he professed this, quote, being offended that Christ would have to shed his blood in order to redeem sinners, end quote. Boy, if that doesn't fulfill the prophecy that the gospel would be a rock of offense to some, that is perfect. That's exactly what Voltaire said. He saw it as disgusting and abhorrent that Jesus would have to die to redeem sinners. He railed against religious intolerance. That is one area that Voltaire's legacy probably was the most lasting, and that is with religious tolerance. The ideas of toleration. He believed that all men should have the ability to think for themselves and the freedom to think for themselves. That was really Voltaire's great charge to the world. He was, like I said, the father of classical liberalism. The idea of being open-minded, being progressive in thinking, and believing for a continual advancement and enlightenment through rationalism and empirical thinking. So really, this is classical liberalism to a core. We will get better as we progress, as we are more tolerant, and we are more open-minded. However, Voltaire, unlike Rousseau, who we'll see in a second, did not think very much about the human condition. In his most notable work called Candide, he argued against the best of all possible world arguments made by Gottfried Leibniz. Now, Leibniz was a theologian who argued this idea that in order to maintain the concept of free will, God had created the best possible of all worlds. That's what he could do. This is just the best God can make it. And so we just have to accept what it is, because this is the best that he could get it. Now, Voltaire absolutely says that is just a horrific idea, because that would totally undermine the omnipotence of God and the omnibenevolence of God, his all-goodness and his all-powerfulness, if this is the best he can do, because of one specific event that happened in 1755 known as the Lisbon earthquake, where 20,000 people were killed in an earthquake there in Lisbon. And Voltaire, this happens in his lifetime, and he says, if this is the best possible world God can do, if this is the best he's got for us, then he is no God of all. So he argues against that. Remember, the problem of evil really bothers him. He took a very stoic approach in this dark world. He basically gave forth this kind of utilitarian idea that will be seen even greater in men like Immanuel Kant. And that is, you basically do the best you can with what you're given. And that's all you can do in this life. You take yourself, you take your bootstraps, you pull yourself up, and you simply do the best with what you got. That's what life is. He maintained a belief in God throughout the rest of his life. Like I said, he was a deist. He argued that this opinion was needed for society. He even wrote this, that if there was no God, quote, there would have to be one invented in order to keep men in line. So this is very much the idea. He says we have to believe in a God, otherwise men will just be crazy and kill each other. That our belief in God, this kind of superstitious belief that there is some kind of overarching judge of the universe, is the only thing that keeps humanity in any kind of check. Knowing he would die soon, he declared, "I die worshiping God, loving my friends, not hating my enemies, and detesting superstition." He hoped to receive a proper Christian burial. He did not want to be buried outside of the Christian graveyard and not be given a burial. And so he wrote a confession to a priest locally where he claimed a belief in God and even asked for a pardon for his sins. However, the most important thing about that letter, that confession, was what was missing. In that letter, he did not mention the name of Christ one time. Not one time did he make any mention of Christ, because he detested the idea of the incarnation and that Christ was God. And unfortunately, I believe, because of that, he died in his sins. He died on May 30th of 1778, but his legacy would be lasting, and to the day we can still feel the effects of Voltaire's thinking in Western civilization. And that brings us to his great counterpart, a man by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He was born in 1712 to a Protestant home there in Geneva. He was actually born in Geneva, and he was the grandson of a Calvinist Genevan pastor. And Rousseau's life was one of really great misfortune. He really saw his whole life as kind of just, if there was ever a guy who just kind of lived his life like Eeyore. If you ever think of Eeyore in the Pooh series, that's kind of how Rousseau writes about himself. He's like, "Oh, it was bad, and this was horrible, and my life is not good, and it was miserable." And that's really Rousseau. Sometimes it's hard to read. You have to really just get to his ideas, because his autobiography is just oftentimes just a kind of woe is me, life is horrible picture. He wrote in his autobiography, quote, "I was born a poor, sickly child and cost my mother her life. So my birth was the first off of my misfortunes." So you can imagine how the rest of that biography is going to go. And that's kind of it. Like I said, if you think of Eeyore, that's kind of the way that Rousseau really writes of his own life. He was a brilliant man, though. While he was a teenager, he had been locked out of the city of Geneva, and in fear of being beaten by his employer the following day because he wouldn't show up to work on time, he just decided, "I'm going to flee Geneva altogether." So he just packed up and left. From that point forward, and wound up in Turin, Italy, and there he would eventually convert to Roman Catholicism for a period. In 1742, he made his way to Paris, thinking that he could win fame through a new system of musical notations that he had devised. Now, Rousseau was the epitome of a womanizer. If ever there was a womanizer, it was Rousseau. For a man whose life was so gloomy, he sure had no problem going after the women. And so what Rousseau would do is he would use influential, very rich and noble French women in society. And he would basically play to them and become basically their boy toy in order to help get himself higher in society. Now, flip the role, and this is something we see very common in American society today. You find somebody who's well off and rich, you don't really like them, but you use them in order to get yourself influence, riches, money, and power. And Rousseau was the king of this. Unfortunately for Rousseau, it ended up in a very great scare when he believed that he had contracted a venereal disease, and that didn't go well for him. And so his lascivious lifestyle turned out to be anything but wonderful and joyous. It was also during this time in Paris that Rousseau met many of the famous philosophers of the day, primarily Denis Diderot and some of the philosophical atheists that we will look at later. And they were vitally influential on Rousseau, both positively and negatively. After Diderot was imprisoned in Vincennes, a prison outside of Paris, Rousseau went and visited him, and Diderot there, who was imprisoned in Vincennes with Rousseau, basically just started to tell Rousseau, "Hey, listen, you're a smart guy, you're brilliant, you need to put your ideas to paper. You need to get them published, you need to make them known." He said, "You need to give them wings and compete for the prize." That was the idea of these philosophers. They believed that they were competing. Who could finally destroy the old rule of Christianity and usher in the period of perfect progress that would give in this idea of full enlightenment? Who could fully rob and prune away all of society from that wicked superstition of Christianity and usher in the pinnacle of reason and humanity in the Enlightenment. That was the prize they believed that they were fighting for. And so Rousseau began to write. And he wrote, and he said that as he began to write, that is when all the madness began for him. In 1750, he wrote his famous essay titled Discourse on the Sciences and the Arts. In this essay, he argued that humans were born good because they were made by the hands of God. All humans were born excellent. However, he used an interesting twist on the nature-nurture argument. He took Locke's ideas that it was ultimately the nurture of humanity that that made them corrupt, but he did so in a way that was radically contrary to anything Locke and any other thinkers thought. He argued that it was not merely just any environment that corrupted mankind. He said it was civilization itself that corrupted mankind. That the only way to keep man good was to keep them in their primal state, to go back to nature. That is the only way that you could keep man good. Therefore, the goal of humanity for Rousseau was to emulate what he called the state of nature as much as possible. And that is where true happiness would be found. Rousseau, in many ways, is kind of the person who brings forth and puts forth the first kind of proto-argument for what we would call, or what has been known as, the noble savage argument. The idea that all of these noble native tribes and groups lived in a state of perfect bliss, egalitarian bliss, with no pain or suffering whatsoever. And it wasn't until civilization was forced upon them that they became wicked and evil. Now, that obviously does not understand anything about those native and tribal groups. Some of the horrors that happened amongst tribal groups and fighting, and Native Americans selling each other into slaves, scalping each other, raiding each other, all of these things that have happened in tribal groups throughout all history, is very clear that it had nothing to do with civilization that brought evil into their hearts. Nevertheless, this was the great idea. If we can go back to that primal state of bliss, there we will find true happiness. It is civilization, it is culture that has made us evil, this competition that has made us wicked and evil. And so Rousseau took an almost monastic concept. He decided to basically give up all gold and jewelry. He got rid of his fanciful stockings. He did not wear the white powdered wigs. As you see there, he would instead wear these brown, just round wigs on his head. That's not a hat, that is a wig. So he would wear these brown wigs on his head to try and just be as humble as possible. He gave up his sword, he gave up his watch, because you do not need time in the perfect state of nature. That was his ideas. And so basically, humans need to return to a more primal and innocent nature to find happiness. And this did something totally counter-contrary to what Rousseau thought. It basically made him lose all credibility with the philosophers. Remember, the goal of the philosophers are trying to create the advancement of civilization. They want to create the picture of perfect humanity, the picture of perfect progress, and the highest state of human rationality and living. And Rousseau saying, well, no, we need to go backwards. We need to go the other way. We don't need to go forward. We need to go backwards. That's where we will find true happiness. And Voltaire especially found this just to be an abhorrent idea. For Voltaire, human happiness is not found in the state of nature, but in the hope and endeavors of progress and the advancement of civilization. Rousseau had sent his work to Voltaire thinking that he was going to get just a friendly critique. Hey, my friend is going to help me out, edit my work, and give me some critique. And instead, much to his own wounding, he got a scathing rebuke from Voltaire in return. Voltaire saw this as the most childish thing he'd ever read. What do you mean go backwards? To undermine everything we're working for, man? However, this did not break Rousseau of his convictions. He argued in a second essay that humans remained in a state of joyful bliss within their original state of nature, and until one person came along and ruined everything. And the one great atom of Rousseau's system of thinking was whoever founded civilization first. Whoever decided to find a plot of land, draw a circle around it, and plant his flag and say, "This is mine." He is the great evil of society. That was Rousseau's idea. Whoever established property, whoever established society and civilization, making men work for him for a wage and living, that man was the great evil, the Adam, the father of all sin. He wrote, quote, "The first man who have enclosed a piece of land thought of saying, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the true founder of society. How many crimes, wars, and murder, how much misery and horror the human race would have been spared if someone had merely pulled up the stakes and filled in the ditch." End quote. In other words, if we would have just stopped that man from saying, "It's not yours, you don't belong, everyone owns it, it's perfect nature, perfect egalitarian, we share the land, we share fruit," as if that was ever the case, it never was. But that was the idea. If someone would have just stopped that man from doing that, then we would have never had these other issues. Despite claiming a respect for the Bible, Rousseau was quick to neglect what it taught about the creation of man and the horrific effects, what we call the noetic effects of the fall. In 1754, Rousseau successfully applied for citizenship in Geneva. Remember, he left there and he was trying to go back and he had to apply for citizenship. Every Western European nation at this point required a citizenship test to become a citizen of their country. This idea that borders have never existed and ideas like that, just not true. You had to take a citizenship test, and that citizenship test often required you to take a test of religion. You had to say whether or not you were a Christian to get into Geneva. And so you had to write basically a statement of faith of what you believe, a testimony, in order to become a citizen of the Republic of Geneva. But once he found out that Voltaire had gone there as well, he decided, "I'm not going to go back to Geneva." He wrote to Voltaire in a letter. He ended it with this basically postscript. Quote, "Sir, I hate you." End quote. So to say, that's how he closed the letter. He did not like Voltaire. After Voltaire had just basically scathingly rebuked and mocked him among the philosophical community of France, he forever had a horrific hatred and animosity towards Voltaire. In some ways, Rousseau was the arch heretic to the philosophical progressivism of many in his days, and he became the herald and champion for a movement which would flow out of him, a movement known as Romanticism. This idea of romanticizing nature, romanticizing the ideals of the original primal state. And you would see these throughout so many thinkers and writers that would come specifically in the 19th century. I think of so many great romantics. And we even had one president especially who probably was the most romanticized president of all in the sense of his views of nature and thinking, and that was Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt was really the great romantic thinker of his days. And so these ideas were really painted first by Rousseau. He said we needed more than just reason. We can't just have reason like all these other philosophers are thinking. We need our internal sentiments. We need a conscience, said Rousseau. We need a conscience. And he believed that the greatest place to find one's internal state, to find the true voice of the conscience, was to be in nature. There's a lot of Alaskans who are very Rousseauian in their thinking, right? Whereas Voltaire denied that God intervened providentially, Rousseau argued that in fact God does intervene. He argued that Voltaire did not really believe in a God at all, but only a devil. Rousseau, when questioned about his belief on providence, wrote, quote, "I have suffered too much in this life not to look forward to another. Not all the subtleties of metaphysics can shake for one moment my belief in the immortality of the soul and a beneficent providence. I sense the existence of providence. I believe in it. I insist on it. I hope for it. And I shall defend it to my last breath." And so in many ways, Rousseau had a very high view of the God of the Bible. It's hard to say exactly where he drew the line, so we shouldn't be dogmatic in saying whether he was or wasn't a Christian. Nevertheless, Rousseau had a falling out with most of the philosophical atheists of the days, including Denis Diderot and David Hume, the great Scottish atheist. In the 1760s, his works became ever more famous, even though he retreated further and further into a place of mental unbalance. In 1762, he wrote one of his most important works titled Emile, which discussed how a young boy, Emile, and a young girl, Sophie, should be raised. Rousseau wanted them to be nurtured according to the principles of nature and to be sheltered, protected from the horrors of civilization. In many ways, Rousseau, not necessarily advocating a Christian principle here, but providing what I believe is truly the correct answer. He wrote, "The family is the first and most holy institution of nature." So he saw the fabric of society being woven by one important thing, and that is the family. Now, you can also, with that statement, say that Rousseau was the greatest hypocrite in history, because Rousseau had illegitimately fathered three children and placed them all in an orphanage, while simultaneously saying that the family was the first and most holy institution of nature. What a great hypocrite, and a sad one in that sense. Though he held Christ in high esteem, Rousseau was his own highest authority, and he was an outright Pelagian. In his work, Social Contract, he believed that all men were a law unto themselves, and that they could only be free by making laws within the context of the general will. He believed that society should have a civil religion to bind it together. Everyone, we should have a civil religion. We must have something that binds us together as a people. He believed this civil religion should have three principal tenets. One, that God exists and rewards good deeds. Two, that God punishes evil deeds. And three, that there should be tolerance for all religions. Now, that's interesting, because not all religions agree with the first two premises, but nevertheless, that was his three things. And he believed a fourth one that was more unspoken and implied, and that is natural religion, that is natural philosophy, general revelation, underlies all religion. Basically, there is one thing that connects all religions. He died on July 2nd of 1778, and his views would remain very influential on men like Immanuel Kant, his view of what was known as the categorical imperative. We'll talk about that another time. And on many other revolutionaries with his idea of the general will. What should be the dominating thing that moves the society forward? Rousseau says it's the general will of the people, otherwise known as majority rule. What the majority says should be the will of society. And we can see how in the French Revolution that would be a very dangerous idea. That brings us to our third group here. Now we've seen the deist, and now we are moving to those who denied God outright. And this is led by Denis Diderot. All our American want to think Dennis, but it was Denis Diderot, and a group called the Philosophic Atheists. Diderot was in every way an intellectual giant. His fields of expertise range from art criticism to chemistry and mechanical technology. He was really a master of a lot of trades and thinking. He was originally trained by the Jesuits, and however, at a very young age, for some reason, we're not quite sure what it was, Diderot turned from the Christian faith, and his view of God not merely just became kind of on the fence or agnostic, but he became very negative towards the God of the Bible. He wrote in his Philosophical Thoughts in 1746, quote, "The thought that there is no God has never frightened anyone, but rather, the thought that there is one, such as the one that has been described to me," end quote. In other words, nobody's ever been afraid because there isn't a God. Everyone's afraid of the God that I've been taught about. In other words, but the problem with that is most everyone always believed in a God. The idea that there is no God, which Diderot would unfortunately not live to see very long, was actually extremely horrifying to people. And it would create a vacuum of meaninglessness in a society that would be very dangerous, and something that we are experiencing full force today. His notable achievement was his work, the Encyclopedia, which in sum accounted for 17 volumes of text and 11 volumes of drawing, making it one of the greatest publishing achievements of the 18th century. It was a massive achievement showing the unity of knowledge. Remember, that was a big thing. Let's try to create a system where we can gather knowledge from all over Europe and the world for people to go and learn about. It consisted of over 220 different writers from all backgrounds contributing a massive number of articles on various subjects. However, Diderot's primary goal wasn't just to create a book where people could find all the knowledge. He was very clear what his goal was. That was to change the way people thought. That was Diderot's goal. The goal was to take things that were orthodox Christian, that to many orthodox Christians they would accept, but to then cross-reference those articles with things that weren't orthodox Christianity in order to slowly and steadily lead people away from orthodoxy. The idea is say something that has truth in it, but then give articles that slowly walk people away from the truths of their biblical Christianity. One example of this was an article in the encyclopedia titled Messiah, where it began by showing all the messianic characteristics of Jesus, but then immediately cross-referencing to an article that argued that Jesus was merely one of many messiahs, not the Messiah. Another one was on Noah's Ark, which the whole article spent time arguing that engineerically speaking, the ark could not float if built to the paradigms of the Bible. That was the whole argument, that if the Noah's ark had been built the way the Bible described it, it never could have floated and would have drowned and been destroyed with the flood. And so here, this is where Diderot is trying to get people lured in and ultimately lead them away with that. And unfortunately, there are some series today, I think of some of the great lecture series that have a series titled The New Testament. And that sounds great, and most Christians would say, oh, here's a great lecture series on the New Testament. Unfortunately, it's taught by a man named Bart Ehrman, who denounces Christianity in every single thing. And so here you would lure Christians in. Oh, New Testament teaching, let me listen to it. By the end of it, they're not believing anything in the New Testament. And this is exactly what Diderot's idea. He found deism completely untenable. Either the God of the Bible exists or he doesn't. Quit trying to find a middle ground. Diderot advocated full and complete atheism. He spent a lot of his writings wrestling with the common questions many atheists have tried to answer. How does inanimate matter become a living being? How does freedom exist in a materialistic worldview where everything is determined by molecules and atoms? How can we say anything about belief or free will or anything like that in a world where we're governed by chemicals and chemistry, brain fizzling together, and how does that work? He had to deal with those things. He writes some very interesting things. You're willing to go check those out. It would take us far too long to expound, but he does try his best to take on those questions. Other atheists during this period were men like Jean Meslier, the French physician Lemaître, who in his work, Man, a Machine, wrote probably the most revolutionary work to this period that changed the thinking, which wrote that man is nothing but a machine of matter with no immortal soul. You can imagine the lasting effects that that kind of ideology has created. He wrote that causes within nature itself may have produced everything. Couldn't explain what those causes were, but they could have. There was something in nature that had to create everything. Other atheistic and agnostic thinkers of this period included Paul Heinrich Dietrich and a man by the name of Helvetius. From Voltaire to Diderot, this new little flock of philosophers, having similar goals in many ways, often had very little in agreement. And in much irony, had just as much infighting as they had ridiculed Christians of having. That's what makes me laugh. The reason they said we need to get rid of Christianity is because they keep fighting each other. All these denominations are springing up. They can't agree. They create their own system of rationality just to find out that they have no standard to rest upon themselves. And they continue to infight. Nevertheless, they were extremely successful in selling the premise that their thinking in the 18th century was truly the height of reason. But I want to show you, beloved, what their thinking brought. What was the end of a worldview that saw man as merely a machine made of matter? A man who does not need God. A man who is the highest end and of himself. I'll tell you what it brought. It was the French Revolution. The French Revolution is what it brought. As the philosophers were dying off, many believed that their age of life would soon die with them. In 1788, the Reformed pastor, Saint Etienne, stated that reason has not advanced. She has only been receding the past 10 years. In other words, these philosophers haven't brought humanity any closer to enlightenment. They've only brought us further back by making us think that we are the end of all things. However, many of the philosophers' ideals were still floated around and were advanced to their brink in the men like atheist Marquis de Condorcet, who believed in the perfectibility of men. He believed that men could be perfected in this life through the right instruction, through the right education, and that all things could be known based upon the highest mathematical probability. That is our great epistemology, Condorcet argues. What is the most mathematically probable? That, beloved, is what we should believe to be absolutely true. Condorcet wrote that eventually reason would triumph over the forces of darkness, including Christianity, and usher in the golden age of civilization. However, in great irony, Condorcet was writing his work of optimism in the middle of very dire circumstances. During the terror of 1793 to 1794, the French Revolution turned very, very bloody. And Condorcet, the man who believed that reason would usher in a period of perfect enlightenment, peace, there would be no more war, no more fighting. No, this man was imprisoned and executed when radical revolutionaries like Maximilian Robespierre captured these men in the name of philosophy and reason for the sake of the national good and the general will of the people, put forth by the arguments of men like Voltaire and Rousseau and Diderot. This is what reason got them. Reason got them having no objective standard of morality, no objective standard of truth, no objective standard of what is right and what is wrong, no objective standard which saw all men created in the image of God and therefore giving full equality in treatment and how they ought to be treated and cared for. It got rid of all the objective standards which God's Word has given us, and they were left with simply the general will. And beloved, the general will of a fallen human nature is a very scary thing. And the French Revolution, all of these men like Maximilian Robespierre, who thought they were bringing in reason's cause, cutting off the head of anyone who disagreed with their movement, anyone that held some sort of vestige to the old past in Christianity, these very men would be killed by their own movements. Robespierre, too, in 1794, would have his head removed by the guillotine that he had used on so many others before him, all in the name of reason. Reason was given the place of God, and the atheistic high priest of that day gladly offered their bloody sacrifices. The bloody reign of terror was soon fought back against by counter-revolutionaries, primarily French Catholics that had been loyal to Rome. Voltaire and Rousseau would have been appalled by these actions. Both these men denied, detested any kind of these actions that people who took their ideas ran with, just as Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon would have detested anything that Voltaire and Rousseau had done with theirs. Beloved, that is the great problem, the great danger of history. Ideas are often exploited and reworked in ways never envisioned by their originators. I think of what we see today with some of the Supreme Court passings. Can you imagine John Jay ever imagining that any of the great court that he sat upon and helped refine on the basis of biblical law would come to what we are seeing today? With laws passed on anything other than the basis of that? I wish Justice Roberts would truly hold true to his argument regarding the precedence of the court. Because if the court's precedents could never be overturned, I sure hope he will go back to John Jay and read his works defining court law on the basis of biblical law. That is where we ought to go, and we've gotten away from it. But this is what we do. We take the ideas of the past and we work them and mold them to fit our context, to justify our causes. And that's what happened in the French Revolution. Though the French Revolution would ultimately devolve back into a need for a strong central leader, because that's what happens, right? When chaos takes place, when anarchy happens, and that's what happened in the French Revolution, it went from the general will of the people rising up, tear down the man, tear down the vestiges of darkness, to automatically everybody's killing everybody. Everybody's becoming a standard to themselves, and when you have chaos, what you have is one strong leader who can bring it all back together. And that is what France would find in a man named Napoleon Bonaparte, who would take all of these revolutionaries and bring them back into the fold as he would crush them and bring them back into the rule, ushering in a period of relative peace for France. The deification of reason and philosophy would not die as many had expected, but remain to this day. Christianity was under great duress in much of Europe, primarily France during this time, because of this movement. But Christianity would stand firm. And next time that we are together, we will look at two ways in which Christianity remained a stronghold in Europe in spite of these new attacks through two very important and connected movements. A resurgent pietism in the Moravians, led by a man named Nicholas von Zinzendorf, and a growing revivalism in a new group of Christianity, a new denomination that is rising up with a revivalistic zeal that is connected very much, a group known as the Methodist, led by men like George Whitefield and the Wesley brothers, John and Charles. And that's where we will look next time. Let's pray. Father God, we just thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the standard of truth that we have therein. We thank you for the reality that we do not need to wonder what is true, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, but we have your supreme standard of authority in the word to constantly go back to. God, I pray this week as we leave here, we are reminded of the thankfulness we have to be able to proclaim the truths of your word freely. And that unlike the French Revolution, many of the American revolutionaries remembered and were fully set upon the reality that only the Christian worldview could provide the basis for which a true republican society could last. God, we thank you for the freedoms we have this week. God, we ask that you would just continue to be with your church, cause us to be the voice that you called us to be bearers of the truth that you've given us. Be with all those if they travel home, keep them safely. And we just say all these things in the name of Christ. Amen.